Welcome back again this week to Solomon on Blast, the show that applies the wisdom, knowledge, and understanding of King Solomon to the confused culture we live in today. We're coming to you from the Power Talk Live studios as part of the Power Talk Live family that has given you the power to think for yourself. You can find us every Saturday here from 11 to 12 on powertalklive.com. Our past show is also available on the show's website, solomononblast.com. You can download the MP3 file and listen when it's convenient for you. Today's show actually marks the second anniversary of our show, 2 years. So it's good to have my co-host back, Pastor Fred. It's good to have you back this week to help celebrate. And if you want to join in, our studio number, 520-750-7456. Mike's here with us running the board and answering the phones. Last week, talked about Mother's Day and the commandment to honor parents. And in that discussion, I referred to a study that was done by the Harvard Medical School that was started back in 1938 that looked at to answer the questions of what physiological and psychological traits present in a man's younger years predict his chances of living a long, flourishing life. And for those who didn't get a chance to hear the show, I'll give you a little bit of background on this. This study was, like I say, to discover what factors led to basically an optimum life. They recruited 268 of Harvard University's sophomores from an all-male class, probably not politically correct today, from 1939 to 1944. And they set out to examine every aspect of their lives for at least a couple decades. And the research project known as the Grant Study continues today with more than 75 years after its inception. It's been extended a number of times and has been one of the longest studies ever conducted. A gentleman by the name of George Valiant, who has been the study's director for several decades, first started working on the project. He was 32 and the participants were in their 50s. Today, Valiant's pushing 80 and the men are in their 90s. The participants continue to fill out their annual questionnaires, and he continues to study the answers. And they're trying to discover what factors really predict a man's ability to become a successful, well-adjusted adult. And as part of this, Valiant created 10 accomplishments that included career success and professional prominence, both mental and physical health, marriage, supportive friendships, closeness to your children, a number of different things. He called these 10 accomplishments the decathlon of flourishing, and he measured the level of each man in the study to see what they had achieved and how they had achieved these events between ages 65 and 80. And he looked back over their personal histories to figure this all out. And when he crunched the numbers, he discovered that no significant relationship between a man's level of flourishing and his IQ. There was no relationship for his body type or even income and education level of his parents. The factors that did show up that really made the difference had one thing in common. And like I said last week, part of that or that main thing was relationships. And last week we talked about the relationship from the aspect of parents where, and that was one of the things, a supportive childhood. The other ones were a mature coping style, being able to roll with the punches, basically, an overall soundness, your resilience. And the one other big factor in it was the warm adult relationships between the age of 37 and 47, i.e. having close friends and maintaining contact with them and being active in social organizations. So this point was even more definitive when there was another study done that because the initial one really didn't have that many and it wasn't that diverse a group. There was another one done in 1940 called the Gruick study along with this one, and they looked at 456 disadvantaged non-delinquent inner city youths from the Boston area. And they went back and looked and see what the success factors were. And again, they were things like being loved by their mothers, admired by their dads, like we talked about last week, and good friendships. So most of the time, having and creating good friendships was a big part of their overall success. And that's obvious even when we look at what Solomon says in Ecclesiastes. He points out what the value of a friend is. He says, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. And he says, though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and threefold cord is not easily broken. So friendship provides that ability to overcome the difficulties in life. So we're going to look at friendship, what it means to be a friend, what it means to find a friend, how to find a friend, and look at it in light of what Solomon says against what the confused culture says. We'll be back with more of Solomon on Blast right after this break. All right, we're back with more of Solomon on Blast, and we're talking about friends and friendship and what it means to be a friend even. Fred just told me that I was actually off a week in terms of our anniversary. It's actually next week, so it's good to have friends to keep you honest. So I guess we'll have to wait until next week to have the birthday cake and do the big celebration. So one of the things that we need to look at is, what does it really mean to be a friend? And I think with the culture out there today, we live in one that's based on instant gratification, you know, Facebook. That's where we look for friends and how many we have. But Solomon says in Proverbs 18:24, he says, a man who has friends must himself be friendly. And then there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. So I think that's maybe one part of it is, what? How do you be a friend? Well, you've got to be yourself friendly enough to have people want to be friends with you. And I think that is something that we don't see a lot of when it's through social media.
Yeah, I think self-absorption would maybe be the right term to use when it comes to trying to overcome, you know, as an obstacle to developing real friendships. And social media plays right into self-absorption, you know. Yeah, absolutely. It's all about what I'm doing, what I ate for breakfast. You know, after so many takes, I'm showing you the best pose that I could come up with in this particular place and whatnot. And so it's all about putting yourself out there. And in real friendship, I think, is the reversal of that.
Absolutely.
It would be your interest in someone else, you know. And I think when you talk about how this is so opposite of what real friendship is, because real friendship is getting outside of yourself, right?
Right. And one of the things that there was a commentary on that verse from Ecclesiastes about two being better than one because they can have a reward for their labor. And in the commentary it says, for as much as when man is alone, he can neither help himself or others. He shows that men ought to live in mutual society to the intent that they may be profitable one to another and that things may increase. That's really kind of what he's pointing out to, that as an individual, you're not going to be able to help yourself when you need help. And in reality, we're supposed to be looking at friendship as a way of helping others, more so than the self-absorption that we're we see.
Yeah, and understanding the bottom line of partnership is actually represents greater potential. And he's saying two are better than one. So when we kind of do our own thing the way we do it, no matter how well we might do it, we like doing our own thing because we get to make all the decisions and we don't have to compromise. But, you know, he says at the end of the day, a partnership trumps somebody doing their own thing. And it doesn't seem that way to us. I think that's a counterintuitive view, especially today, that people think that's the ultimate expression. You know, learning to love yourself is the greatest love of all, Whitney mm-hmm. taught us. And so, you know, with that mindset, you think, wow, if you can just do it all by yourself, then you've really done it right. But it's really the opposite, because you're cutting yourself off from such a fundamental need for human interaction and participation.
Yeah, and with society being such a competitive environment, especially in the sports, you know, they focus on that one superstar player, and everybody thinks that, well, that's really the solution, is you've got to be that one superstar, and they don't look at the fact that there still is a whole team behind that individual, that if they weren't there, you know, and you're that great running back and you didn't have any linemen to defend you, you'd be laid out pretty quick. So I think the culture focuses on those that are the superstars, as if, as an individual, you can accomplish things
by
yourself.
Yeah, you're a mere role player. But, you know, I think marriage reflects this today, the lack of partnership. You know, we talk mm-hmm. about married couples being best friends, and, you know, I think that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of people. Usually it's the woman who says something like that.
Right.
I don't know if they talk about different lipstick shades or what that makes them best friends. But, you know, really what makes a couple best friends is that they're really good partners. They trust each other. They respect each other. They're on the same page. They're loyal to each other. And they have each other's back. And they also watch for each other's integrity, you know.
Yeah.
And a partnership, I think, is the best kind of friendship in that context, because that's part of what he's saying here. He's not just talking about sentimental feelings being exchanged between people, which I think is an outgrowth of that, obviously.
Right.
But he's talking about how they bind together, and binding together, their skills and their qualities are almost, you know, it almost has an exponential effect on that. It makes not just double it; it makes it even better than double.
Right, And I think with this, like I said at the beginning, this age of instant gratification, sometimes we don't take the time to really figure out if somebody can be a friend. You know, you see that in a lot of cases where a one-time meeting doesn't always guarantee that that's the future.
Yeah.
And I remember a good friend of mine now. I remember the first time I met him, and I thought, man, this guy's pretty arrogant, kind of one of those East Coast, stuck up, you know, better than everybody else kind of thing. And as we got to know each other, we, you know, it took a number of times. It wasn't just that one situation. And as we got to know each other better, we realized we had, you know, we had good communication. And actually, at one point, we were standing in church, and he looked over at me and goes, you know what, I didn't like you when I first met you. And I looked back and I said, that's okay, because I didn't like you either. But, you know, we're very good friends now. So just that first perception isn't always the right one, and it takes some time. And I think that's maybe what the culture says, you know, everything's got to be instantaneous, and it's not about really building.
And I think you're putting your finger on something else as well, and that is that today many people are too hypersensitive mm-hmm. to really get close to somebody.
Right.
Because, you know, people are not always going to say the right thing. They're not always going to send the vibe you're looking for.
Right.
Or the one you appreciate most. Then what do you do? But if you're not too super sensitive, you can just put it on the back burner and say, well, I'll think about something else. And then later on you realize, this guy's not so bad, you know.
Yeah.
So,
and I think maybe at times it's easier for men to be able to do that than the women are. And in looking at this, I was thinking of it more from that aspect, that as men, having another man in your life as a good friend, yeah, we need our wives to stabilize us and to keep us on the straight and narrow, but at times there's situations where you really need to have that man in your life to, as a man, to be able to speak into your life and make you think the right way.
Yeah, I think here's one of the things that I've always appreciated in different kinds of friends is honesty. I always think someone has to just be what they are. Mm-hmm. I don't care if they agree with me. Don't worry. I can argue with you. I'm okay. I'm not offended by that. But I want someone to be straight. I want them to say what they think and be what they are. And if someone can say to me, I didn't like you, as long as I felt it was honest and not manipulative, right. Because certain people say that out of manipulation too, you know. That could be a manipulative right. comment, trying to get you to react a certain way, one way or another. But, you know, it just, I know the person I think you're talking about here, and I would say that would just be a straightforward comment.
Right.
But I think, you know, in general, honesty, straightforwardness, you're not being pretentious, you're not playing an angle. Mm-hmm. I think all of those things that you want to kind of test. Is there an angle here? Is there right. You know?
And the honesty of that comment made me reflect on, okay, how do I really come across to other people at times? Is that something that I need to look at to adjust or improve upon, that if I do I come across to most people that way that, oh, you know, I didn't like you when I first met you. What am I doing that would create that situation? And so the honesty of it is something that you can look at and make improvements on your life if you're willing to.
Now, if you're a woman, you could kind of like dissect this thing, you know, forever, and you'd say, well, maybe he picked up on your vibe, and his vibe was a reaction to you. So, you know, you could get that crazy kind of thinking. But I see you have here, you know, this Solomon's statement, iron sharpens iron.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. I mean, that's how men relate to each other.
Right.
That's why men like each other. In this sense, anybody that's ever played on a ball team, you know, if you had locker room, it's all iron sharpens iron in a locker room. And this is one of the things that a politically correct environment does not accept, or and I think they still do it very much, but they just have to keep it on the down low, you know, because mm-hmm. everything that comes out of a locker room full of guys can be offensive.
Right.
80% of it could be, you know, absolutely. Red tag right there. You know what I mean? They could just completely condemn it and come and knock down the building with all the players in it, because that's kind of how it works. And that's very male. And you can try to change that all you want. But see, political correctness just drives those things underground is what it does. It doesn't eliminate them. It drives it underground. And it actually makes outlaws out of the people who like to talk
mm-hmm.
straight, right?
Right. And I think the military is another aspect of that. The bonds that are built in the military and in when you're fighting for your lives next to each other, historically you see that in a lot of cases. The one miniseries that Tom Hanks did on the Band of Brothers after Stephen Ambrose's book, The Band of Brothers, is just an amazing story of how these guys really banded together, and they had to be able to help each other survive. And I don't think you can get that kind of closeness if there isn't the ability to be honest and an understanding that, you know, this is life or death in some cases.
Yeah, well, I think, again, there's another great reason which really motivates men is that's a common purpose.
Right.
When men feel like they're really linking together for some kind of real cause, you know, that makes all the difference in the world. For example, in pastoring, trying to create a quote-unquote fellowship. A fellowship basically is just Christians eating lots of food.
Right.
And holding discussions in between bites. That's not a real easy venue for men, I've noticed. Men are like, hey, how you doing? Good.
Right.
Good. How's the this? How's the
if it even gets that far, more than
you know, there's sports, there's cars, there's like a very few topics, and usually, you know, it's pretty stagnant. But you get those men like around like a project, and then everything changes. And so I've seen it. I've seen men rally around a project where they're building something, and suddenly then everything changes. You know, the juices flow. They start giving each other a hard time. They start mocking the way each other swings a hammer. You know, and
the
then
dynamics.
They're kidding with each other now, and they're shooting the breeze, and they're laughing, and and so everything completely changes in the way men relate to each other when there's something to do. It kind of like causes the engine to rev a little bit. But when you're standing there trying not to get in trouble by saying the wrong thing and have your wife throwing glances at you, that's a difficult way to relate, you know?
Absolutely. And some of the best friendships that I've had have been with people that, for me, that I hunt with. It's probably one of the most difficult environments to find somebody that you can hunt well with. It's not that easy. There's people that just don't hunt the way you do, have different viewpoints on doing it. And the ones that I've been able to have a good experience with have become very, very close friends. And it's just a different dynamic in there. And it's not an easy one to fill that connection with somebody. It takes a lot of time. I've hunted with a number of different people at different times, and some of it's just like, okay, there's no way I can ever go hunt with this guy again. Or you hunt a little bit, but there's just not that connection with them. But when there is that connection, it becomes a very, very tight bond that you just kind of click together.
It's kind of, again, it's the band of brothers thing. That really causes you to open up and relax. And what you're just talking about, what causes men to relax, to be themselves, and right. to enjoy being around, you know, some other people.
Right. All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll come back with more of Solomon on Blast right here on Power Talk Live. Don't go away. Bit of Beatles, getting by with a little help from my friends, because we're talking about friendship here this week. And one of the things I think that has changed a lot in our culture is the dynamics of really male friendship isn't there like it used to be. There were a lot of different organizations that men were part of that allowed them to develop those long-term relationships. And with our, like I say, the quick, on-the-move-go society, it's hard, you don't see that really in the world today, in our culture. You know, there's a lot of people are moving too much, you know, that, whereas before there was a lot of stability in where you lived and the length of time you lived there, so you could really build those relationships. And a lot of that seems to have gone by the wayside. I was looking at some of the historical writings. People like Daniel Webster, their letters to male friends would say things that today would be, people would, you know, raise an eyebrow or two. One of his letters, he began was "my lovely boy" and ended it with "a very affectionately yours." Now today that might not go over so well, but in that time frame, it was the norm. There was a lot more, I guess, affection, much more closeness in those male relationships that maybe is a little bit harder to accomplish in today's PC world.
Exactly. Well, in fact, when I was looking over these notes, I wrote down a couple of thoughts here, and that is, I think one of the things that hurts relationships today, and we're really kind of zeroing in on the men, I guess, mm-hmm. that's more within our realm of expertise.
Yep.
But it has to do with sexual identity. See, now you're getting into sexual identity issues that are so huge. In 2016, you know, we are talking about the movement now. I mean, the edict coming down from King Obama was that elementary schools need to basically open their bathrooms to whatever kid right. would view themselves as, which to me, just on the level of psychology, is an amazing question as to how healthy is it to allow young children to begin to question these things when they're in no place to figure these things out.
Right. They have
emotionally, they're just in no place to do that. And yet these kids are being somehow given this amazing ability in their minds, this amazing ability to sort all these extremely complicated ideas out by the time you're 4 and 5 years old. It's absurd.
Right. You're still trying to figure out why you can't have Fruit Loops every morning for breakfast.
All this is placed in the sensitivity arena. How sensitive and caring are you and tolerant? What about the fact that they're emotionally and psychologically abusing these children by opening this door in their minds at such a young age? Don't worry. You know, we're a free and open society. At some point, they can choose to do, if that's what they really want to do.
Right.
They can do the Caitlyn Jenner thing if that's really where it goes at some later period of their lives. But to be 5 and 6 years old, where you're not even sexually developed to begin to answer these kinds of questions, all they're doing is creating incredible insecurity in these children. Now the child can't be sure of that either. They can't be sure of a lot of things. And they can't be sure of that either. So having said that, you superimpose this over the way people relate today, and mm-hmm. You hypersexualize a society. Everything is in question. Can I get close to this person? Or is this friend, this good old buddy, is going to turn around and say, I have feelings, you know? I mean, my God, that would make everybody put a big fence and a wall around themselves and saying, I need to protect myself, because you don't know where it's coming from.
Right. And in looking back at there was a bunch of photographs that I'd found of old photographs back in the 1800s, early 1900s of men. And the photographs would be considered very risque in today's world, where there's men standing there literally holding hands. I mean, a picture of them, but you can tell they're men, they were manly. It wasn't that they were considered homosexual or anything. It was just a norm. And I think in looking back at some of this, they were free to have those relationships because there wasn't this whole concept of homosexuality as we know it in society today. I mean, there was that wasn't a big part of it.
The first time I visited Africa back in the 90s, I saw we were downtown and these two guys were walking by arm in arm. And so I kind of paused and I asked the guy with me, did I just see what I saw? I mean, are these guys? Mm-hmm. And he goes, oh, no, man, it's not like that here. I remember saying, no, it's not that way here. It's not. And in fact, if you know anything about the countries in Africa, they're probably one of the last holdouts when it comes to accepting, you know,
close relationships,
the homosexual ideas that are so prevalent in the West. And so it's not at all, but it's just culturally, because that idea is not automatically looked at.
Right. You looked at it automatically that
way.
Yeah,
I did. I kind of paused, and I looked at it, and I watched this thing kind of, and the guy kind of smiled and said, yeah, that's not what that means. I mean, that's a very common culture. He says, especially people that come in from the bush, where their cultures are even less exposed to the West,
right.
He said would be more likely to just to not have any clue. You'd almost have to tell them, hey, you know, this is the way it could look. And then they would be embarrassed and laugh, you know.
Yeah. And the research that I was doing, one of the articles said it wasn't really until the turn of the 19th century when psychologists started analyzing homosexuality that men started to became much more self-conscious about their relationship with their men, friends. And they had to trade off that close embrace for what he referred to as the man hug. You
did
know,
you ever
nice
see
back.
Bill and Ted's Great Adventure? Remember that back in the 90s?
Yeah, I remember.
Where they hugged each other.
Oh, yeah.
And then they pushed each other.
It was like, whoa, don't get
too
close.
Watch out.
Right.
So it's kind of like that. You know, I thought they captured that really well in that little moment.
And the other thing they said was that a lot of times, because of the way the culture was, men and women didn't intermingle as much. So they were very much separated society, and that required that, you know, you had to develop relationships, close relationships with the people that you lived with. And that was, in most cases, men lived with men, and women lived with women, or you lived at home, and you didn't have that whole interaction throughout society the way they do today.
And people could live together, and that wouldn't be a factor beyond that question. You know, there's a phrase that goes back, the Boston marriage. You ever heard this phrase?
No, I hadn't.
The Boston marriage was the idea of two women who, spinster women, living their lives together as a partnership. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like anybody thought, oh no, they must be in love or they must be lovers. They're just two women. And if you look back in the older television shows, they kind of demonstrated this. Remember one of Lucille Ball's shows, not the first one, but her second big show. I forgot, probably the Lucy show, you know, they all had the same names. But, you know, she had a friend that they lived with, they're both families, two single parents living in the same home, mm-hmm. raising their kids together. I mean, it wasn't like a crazy, it wasn't anything you put any
sexual
implication
right?
to it.
Yeah, it wasn't sexual.
It was just a couple of really close friends that trusted each other, and they lived in the same house, and they raised their families, and they kind of made it together, you know.
Right. And so that's kind of the history behind it. It just didn't. It wasn't that big a deal. But the other aspect of the friendship thing is, you know, there's people out there that you want to avoid. Right, I mean, Solomon's pretty clear. He says, "He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will be destroyed." So sometimes you've got to put boundaries in place and figure out, is this person really somebody that I want to have as a friend? And for me, I think that was a big aspect of dealing with my youngest son. He thought anybody, you know, everybody he referred to was a friend, and I said, why do you always say friend? There's a definition to what friend really is, and it just gets used in a cavalier manner a lot of times that, wait, what are you defining as a friend? I don't know if you'd want to be hanging out with that particular person. So you've got to put boundaries in place and analyze, you know, is this somebody that's a wise person that I'm going to walk with and be wise, or is this one of those companion fools that end up destroying things for me?
You know, when I was young, I used to really get a kick out of the crazier kind of personalities because it was not like mine. So a crazier, more outgoing kind of guy that was willing to try different things, you know. And I remember just thinking, man, this guy's funny, or he's brash, and kind of, you know, enjoying that, seeing that, not me doing it, but seeing somebody else do it. And
living a little vicariously through his behavior.
And dropping little statements to, you know, my own thoughts and statements, and seeing this guy act him out to see if the line floats or not, you know. But I can see the appeal in a kid. You know, there are certain people that appeal to you, you know. They're like I said, they're funny, and or they're good fighters, or whatever the case might be.
Yeah.
And you have to be really careful because there is an appeal there.
Right. And so you have to have that ability to analyze and say, what is it that makes for a good friend versus what is it that makes for a bad friend? What should I be watching out for?
I think a bad friend is all based on fun, you know?
Yeah. There's no real relationship. It's what you can get away with.
Yeah, exactly. A good time. Are they going to try to break a window or steal or that sort of thing, you know?
Right. And Solomon also says the righteous should choose his friends carefully, for the way of the wicked leads them astray. So there are specific criteria that Solomon's presenting here. Another one, he says, make no friendship with an angry man. And you see that in a lot of cases. I had a friend that, good high school friend, and I saw that, boy, he had a real temper at times. And I had to kind of separate myself, distance myself from that environment, because it would create a lot of trouble, and you could get in a lot of trouble.
Oh, you can get into a lot of fights like that.
Exactly.
You know?
And that was his manner, was he didn't have a problem fighting. And I think part of it was that he was, his dad was in the military, so he had been in different areas of the world. They actually, when I first met him, they had just come back from Guam. And 13, 14 years old, and he had spent a couple years over there. It was a different world than what we live in here. He said they didn't like Americans, so if you were an American over there, they beat you up because you were an American. So he said you had to learn to fight. And I think a lot of that is, I saw that in his reaction to situations, was, you know, because of the fact that he had to defend himself in a lot of cases for no reason.
You know, it's interesting, along with this, in the New Testament, it warns fathers, don't provoke your children to anger. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, how you deal with your kids, how you deal with their failures, how you deal with their, you know what I mean, with their frustrations and whatever, really goes a long way to almost like, it reminds me of, you know, some people like to make their pit bulls
right
bite.
Yep, which is why they get such a bad rep.
They get a stick and they just annoy the heck out of that thing until it's just always annoyed.
Right.
That's what people inadvertently do with their kids, you know. They just annoy them, and the kids are angry.
Right. And, you know, we have this view of who we want our kids to hang out with, and you have things, you know, you have to make those decisions. You say, okay, that isn't the kind of kid that I want my kid to hang out with because it's a bad influence. But the problem comes when, what happens when it's your kid that you wouldn't want your kid to hang out with, right? When that child has gotten to a point where, hey, I don't want other kids hanging out with my kid, how do you deal with that particular situation? And that's a difficult one to address.
Right, because you're always rooting for your kid. And
right.
You want your kids to hang out with better people.
Right.
Right?
So,
unfortunately,
sometimes yours is the one that you don't want your own kid to be hanging out with, or other people's kids. So we have to look at that aspect of it. And it is a difficult situation to deal with, but hopefully, and I can personally attest to that being the case at one point with my youngest son. I don't want other kids hanging out with him. This isn't the kid who his friend should be hanging out with.
Here's another one. You want your son to find like a fantastic young woman, obviously, you know. That's your goal. That's your hope. But the question is, are they prepared for that themselves? Will they reciprocate the fantasticness, you know? So right. That's another question. It's like everybody wants the best for their kids. But friendship, at the end of the day, requires some mutual cooperation.
Yeah, and when you start looking at the fact that the culture is all about the social networking, the online stuff, really, that when you boil it down to what it really amounts to, it's not a friendship. There was a study done, and it says when someone speaks to you face to face, what percentage of meaning is actually in the words as opposed to body language and your tone of voice? They were looking at it, okay, when we're communicating face-to-face, how much do you really get out of words versus the person's actions and that kind of thing? And they came up with the number that only 7% of it is words. The other 90%, 93% is a nonverbal communication. And so when you're doing social media, all you have is the words, which is only 7% of real communication between two people when you're losing 90.
Unless they use a lot of caps and exclamation marks.
The emoticons and everything else. So
that might add a little bit.
Right. It becomes you lose a lot of what it really means to develop that relationship and friends. And maybe there is one advantage to having mostly online friends, and it's one that nobody ever really talks about, and kind of what we talked about at the beginning, that is they demand less of you, right? There is no burden if you've got a lot of online friends. They're not expecting you to support them. It is all about you. And the third part that Solomon talks about, I think, is those friends that maybe aren't really friends. I guess I would call them the fake friends. And my question would be, was this Solomon's view of things because of who he was? He says, wealth makes many friends. And he also says that many entreat the favor of nobility, and every man is a friend to one who gives gifts. And I'm wondering if, you know, for Solomon, with his wealth and everything, how well could he trust people to be a friend just to be a friend versus...
Yeah, I think that's his point. I think his point was when you're a rich guy,
everybody wants to be your friend. And we see that in the world today. That is the world
view.
Which
I think, explains the ridiculousness of people like Leonardo DiCaprio. They're surrounded by everyone that says you're brilliant, you're smart. Okay, here's your check. Everything you think, everything you say, every statement you make is just absolute, you know, gold. And they go forth and, you know, they give a speech on global warming and then get into a private plane with a carbon footprint, half the size of Cleveland. And they go do what they do. And they don't even ever make the connection between the two ideas. And I think that explains that people's friends are based on the fact that they're wealthy, they're successful, they're celebrity, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's what he's really saying.
Yeah, I think so.
So the question is, I think you asked it, did he have friends? And I think maybe he's wondering.
Yeah, in that statement he made.
It'd be a pretty lonely place, you know.
Right. And there's a book written by C.S. or just a, not really a book, but an article written by C.S. Lewis called The Inner Ring. And it really is talking about getting into that inner ring, inner circle, where you kind of have those close relationships and friendships. But when he goes through the article, when you really read it and understand it, in a lot of cases, that inner circle isn't what you expected it to be. And he says in that article, he says, of all the passions, the passion for that inner ring is most skillful in making a man who is not yet a very bad man do very bad things. And I think that's kind of what Solomon's pointing out here, is you got to be very careful about what you're going after when it becomes looking for a friend, and the fact that you can end up doing a lot of things that you would normally not be willing to do in search of that inner circle, that inner group of friends that is for some reason.
And what makes that circle so dangerous is that somewhere that's being driven, you know, by whoever's the ringleader, you might say, right, and other ringleaders by enormous self-interest, and they're looking to add people constantly to their cause that can promote their ultimate goal.
Right.
And you know, which I think turns to the truest definition of friendship, is what you have here, you know, is to suspend. The real friendship is based on someone's willingness to suspend their own self-interest for the interest of somebody else. I mean, right? I think
right.
False friendship is all based on self-interest and adding people to help you promote your interests.
Right, that creating that inner circle that is going to support you.
By the way, I just have to say that, if nothing else, Zuckerberg and these guys are brilliant at using the word friend as a euphemism for electronic follower.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an amazing, idea to put out there, because there are probably a lot of people that don't have a lot of friends, and that word makes them feel much better,
right,
even though it doesn't amount to much of a friendship with anybody.
Right. And that's kind of, you know, the comment I made with regards to my son, that it was so cavalier to use the word friend, and that was way before Facebook really became popular. Now we have an even more cavalier use of the word friend when there's such a significant aspect to what it really means. And we always take it back to, you know, one greater than Solomon in Jesus. And in John 15, he says, greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. And I think that kind of what you're alluding to is that laying down your life for a friend is what really defines true friendship. It's not how many friends do I have on Facebook, but that one friend that's willing to give it all for you. And I think that we can see from the culture today, you know, now it's all about what can I get from everybody else, how many likes can I get from people, instead of what can I do for somebody else. And I think that's kind of what you're alluding to there with that aspect of it. All right, so we're just about out of time here this week. We appreciate everybody listening. Coming up next, Jake Feinberg show is coming up next. He's sitting right here ready to go. So we'll be back again next week. And in the meantime, like we always say, think wisely, and think wisely now about who's a true friend. We'll see you next week.
When you're down and trouble, and you need a helping hand, and nothing, oh, nothing's known. Soon I will be there to brighten up even your darkest night. You just call.